I'm J.G. Michael, and this is Parallax Views.
Hello, this is Mike Swanson, and in a few moments, you're going to listen to another segment of Parallax Views. But before you do that, let me tell you about my new book, Why the Vietnam War. It's a sequel to my previous book called The War State, which has lots of positive reviews and Amazon's been out for years. But this one is a more detailed case study of how American Empire and National Security State operate using Vietnam. And I believe it shows also how things work today, how policy is actually made and why. So grab the book on Amazon.com, Why the Vietnam War.
Hey there, Parallax Views listeners. On this edition of the program, we're going to be talking about the years of revolutionary terror that struck Italy from the 1960s until the 1980s with historian Richard Drake of the University of Montana. The second edition of Drake's 1989 book on Italy's years of revolutionary terrorism from both the left and the right, otherwise known as the Years of Lead, has just been republished in a new second edition. It's entitled The Revolutionary Mystique and Terrorism in Contemporary Italy, and I have to say, it may provide useful insights for some of the problems we could be facing in the future, both in the United States and abroad. All that and more on this edition of Parallax Views, and now on to the conversation with Richard Drake, author of The Revolutionary Mystique and Terrorism in Contemporary Italy. Welcome back to Parallax Views. Professor Richard Drake, a historian at the University of Montana, we had you on a while back to talk about the anti-imperialist historian Charles Baird. This time, you're on to discuss with us the second edition of your book, The Revolutionary Mystique and Terrorism in Contemporary Italy. How are you doing today, Richard?
I'm doing very well, and you, sir?
Very good, very good. I was really pleased when I found out that you had a second edition of this book coming out, because I've been wanting to do an episode on what's known as the Years of Lead in Italy. For my listeners that may be unfamiliar, what was the Years of Lead?
The Years of Lead in Italy occurred from the late 1960s until well into the 1980s, nearly a 20-year period, during which terrorism from the left and the right ravaged Italy. And when I wrote this book, originally the book appeared in 1989, I wanted to describe what that terrorism had been like and what the causes of it had been.
So in regards to the Years of Lead, how does it really start in Italy? How does this moment of terrorism, both black and red, as it's been put, how does this come to arise in post-war Italy in, I believe, what, 1969 is when it really kicks off?
Yes. I think two things need to be mentioned. First, the revolutionary traditions on the left, the Marxist left and the fascist right, long have been deeply entrenched in Italy. So there are these ongoing traditions there that have proved to be very attractive to large numbers of people for a very long time. The second point concerns the economic decline that befell Italy, really starting in the early 1960s. Italy had gone through, after World War II, what became known in English as il boom, It was a very successful period of industrial growth in Italy from about 1947, 48, beginning with the Marshall Plan investment in Italy. And that period of growth progressed strongly until about 1962 or 1963. And then the slowdown occurred, which was compounded by serious troubles in the university system, people graduating with no real job prospects. So I think it's a combination of social and economic forces and cultural, ideological forces that made the problem of terrorism unusually severe in Italy, beginning in the late 1960s.
You said unusually severe. How was this maybe different than terrorism of a political variety in other Western countries? I think in the U.S. we'll hear about things like the Weather Underground and, you know, matters like that. But what's different about Italy in the years of lead?
First of all, I think the intensity of the violence from both the radical left and the radical right, terror bombings on the radical right, beginning with Piazza Fontana, that was a bombing at a bank in Milan in December of 1969, which really inaugurated the years of lead. And also on the radical left, particularly with the Red Brigades, but numerous other groups as well. The Red Brigades were merely the most famous of these radical left-wing groups who contributed a Marxist-Leninist dimension to the mayhem in Italy as well. And so I think statistically, Italy suffered the worst terrorist violence in the industrial world. You're right. In the United States, we had the Weather Underground. Other countries had terrorist eruptions as well. One thinks of for example, the ETA and the Basque country of Spain, various problems and the troubles in Ireland. In Germany, there's Baader-Meinhof. There certainly were other terrorist movements in other countries, but Italy's case was exceptional in terms, not only in terms of the number of terrorist episodes, but for the duration of the problem. We're talking about a 20-year period here of almost unbroken disturbance in the civic life, the political life of Italy. And I don't think any other country quite endured, any other industrialized country quite endured what the Italians did during the age of lead, the years of lead.
And this includes bombings, assassinations. I mean, this is really intense stuff. You mentioned the Piazza Fontana incident. Could you explain that a little more for my listeners who may be unfamiliar with it?
I was living in Italy at the time of the Piazza Fontana bombing. I remember very well the shock, dismay, and horror that that event produced in December of 1969. It was shocking for people. First of all, what happened there was, it turns out, a radical right-wing group, members of the Ordine Nuovo, the New Order, radical right-wing group, set a bomb in a bank, the Banca di Agricoltura in Milan, killing more than 90 people and wounding a couple of hundred more. A bombing of exceptional violence, bloodshed, destructiveness, and that really started the ball of terrorism rolling in Italy, because people on the right then feared that Italy might once again go through a fascist phase. Remember, fascism was conceived in Italy. The first fascist regime was that of Benito Mussolini. And the fascist tradition really has never died out in Italy. So on the left, there was great concern that this Piazza Fontana bombing might be the signal for a surge of right-wing radicalism, which the left then resolved to meet. And it really is this collision of two revolutionary extremes that detonated the explosion in the years of lead.
Now, what's really interesting, I think when people hear the term revolutionary, they always think that it's, you know, almost just a left-wing thing. But right-wing, far right-wing terrorism, it does have a revolutionary aim. I mean, far right-wing terrorism of the variety that we saw during the years of lead was an attempt to overthrow an entire system. I mean, that was the goal and end game or goal.
I think this is true. That I think it's a misconception to think of fascism merely as a right-wing establishment force. There are definitely a revolutionary currents in fascist theory and even in fascist practice. For example, the leading philosopher of fascism was a man named Giovanni Gentile, who wrote a book in the 1920s called The Origins and Doctrine of Fascism. He tried to really lay out what the distinctive features of fascism were. And a cardinal feature of fascist theory really is to overturn the liberal capitalist system on the grounds that the liberal capitalist system has no real concern about the racial or cultural integrity of the collective, which is uppermost in the thinking of fascists. And so there's a really hard line opposition, I think, embedded in fascism to the liberal capitalist status quo, even though during the fascist years, Mussolini cooperated with the capitalist system. There always were elements in the fascist movement opposed to that, and really to the left of him, or better yet, to the radical right of him. And those elements have continued in existence down to the present day in 2021, which is another reason why I thought it was a good idea to bring out a second edition of the book. This book is 32 years old, but I deal a lot with the fascist and Marxist-Leninist revolutionary traditions, which both of which I think need to be understood today in order to prepare ourselves for a surge of revolutionary politics in our ever-darkening time.
So in regards to, I want to get into the Red Brigades, but before we get into that, if we could, what are some of the main groups, organizations, and people involved in the sort of black terrorism that goes on during the years of lead, or the fascist end of terrorism in that time?
I think, again, it's important to make distinctions here, because the main neo-fascist party in Italy in the post-World War II period into the years of lead era was the Movimento Sociale Italiano, the MSI, the Italian Social Movement. This is a very broad right-wing party that contained diverse elements, some of which were more radical than others. And it was on that radical end of the neo-fascist party that such groups as Ordine Nuovo, the New Order, which was inspired largely by the ideas of Julius Evola, who described himself as a super fascist during the fascist period. And he really inspired the Ordinovisti, the members of Ordine Nuovo, who were on the most extreme end of the political ideological spectrum and were open to violent strategies in overturning the consumer society, American dominated status quo in Italy. And I think that had revolutionary implications, which played out during the years of lead.
You know, since you mentioned Julius Evola, Let's talk a little bit about him. I've done a few shows where he's been mentioned before, but it's interesting. There were really figures in Italy at the time that really looked up to Evola when it came to these neo-fascist movements. I think there's even one figure in your book whose name eludes me that referred to him as R. Marcuse, or R. Marcuse, in reference to Herbert Marcuse of the Frankfurt School, which
that was Giorgio Almirante, who was a member, a neo-fascist member of the Movimento Sociale Italiano. You have a good memory.
So obviously this indicates that he was very important to the sort of philosophy of these Italian neo-fascists. What is the sort of ideology and philosophy of Julius Evola? Because his sort of view of fascism or neo-fascism, I think, would surprise some people. He sort of believes in an almost, I guess, spiritual racism as opposed to a biological racism.
There are many components in Evola's ideology. Some of them are spiritual. Some of them have to do with Eastern philosophies. But I think his political ideology and the main message he had for the right wing, the radical right wing in Italy, was that the existing status quo, the consumer society that had taken shape in Italy, really because of the Marshall Plan and the boom of the post-World War II years, was an intrinsically evil system that was bound in the end to lead to the destruction of Italy, of its Italianness. And one of the reasons why some of these ideas are coming back into favor in Italy today really has arisen over the crisis produced by non-European immigration in Italy. There are various groups that are benefiting from the anger and dismay in Italy over rising numbers of immigrants from North Africa and the Middle East. And as a result of that anger and dismay, some of the political ideas of the neo-fascists, not only Evola, but also Ezra Pound, who's another very important figure in the history of fascism. He was an American poet, who lived in Italy for 20 years during the fascist period and became a fascist, an ardent proponent of fascism. And his ideas are also very influential today on the radical right, largely because of the negative response to non-European immigration into Italy today. So that's why I think these ideas have somehow found a way to come back. You know, at the end of World War II, people assume, well, fascism and Nazism are dead and gone. They're never going to reappear. After this devastating defeat they've experienced in 1945, that's the end of them. Well, it wasn't the end of them. It never was the end of them. They continued in existence. I think they're becoming more and more appealing to the people who are most angry about globalization, about non-European immigration. Those are the two driving issues in right-wing politics today, which is a highly varied phenomenon in Europe. It has Trump elements in it. Trump is a great role model for many of these right-wing populist movements, but also in that mix of right-wing anger and right-wing resistance to the status quo, of which the United States is the epitome, mixed in with that are these fascist and neo-fascist elements. Evola, Pound, and others, I think, have generated a kind of renaissance for themselves. And
I think there's even a movement in Italy, the Casa Pound movement.
That's very look, the Casa Pound has a website. I don't know if you're looking at it right now, but the Casa Pound on its website claims to have 20,000 members in some 200 centers across Italy. And so I think that's just another sign of a growing anger, a growing discontent with the status quo. Italy, of course, is going through right now a very severe economic crisis, huge unemployment problems there, especially for young people. You know, the 17 to 34 age demographic right now is experiencing close to 40% unemployment. You know, you get 40% unemployment, some very serious opposition figures start to show up. Nazi Germany had 40% unemployment in the early 1930s. And of course, that opened the door for Hitler and the Nazis. And that it's not just Germans who are vulnerable to conditions like that and responding politically in an extreme way.
If we could, you mentioned that we are seeing a rise in far-right thought, in far-right movements in Western countries today due to the crises of globalization. One of the sort of key themes within Julius Evola and his thought is sort of this really visceral, vehement reaction towards modernity. Is there a relationship between modernization in Italy and the rise of this sort of black fascist terrorism?
In the case of Evola, the key book to read by him is Revolt Against the Modern World. He wrote that in the 1930s and then issued an update of the book after World War II. This is the holy book for neo-fascists. It's almost a sacred text for them. There are other books by him that are very important as well. I would say the most important of his later books, two of them really, Men Among the Ruins, which he wrote in 1953, and then To Ride the Tiger, that's early 1960s. Those books have generated a large degree of enthusiasm on the right wing, and not only in Italy. I mean, he has sort of an international appeal. Now, all of his major books have been translated into English. So I think his intellectual itinerary is a fundamental place to look for the origins and character of what neo-fascist culture really consists of. And what I try to provide in the book, in my chapter on Evola, is a systematic analysis of his work, his ideas, his career. And I hope that it will serve as a good introduction for people who want to understand what neo-fascism is, how it originated, and what its prospects are for today.
In regards to that chapter, you also talk about the Bologna train bombing. What is the relationship between Evola and that train bombing, or at least, you know, some of the characters involved in that bombing and maybe the influence that Evola had on them?
Well, look, Evola was a philosopher. He was not certainly in the neo-fascist, in the post-World War II period, a political activist. He was a writer. And writers cannot be blamed for the way readers interpret their books. That was his constant defense whenever he was charged with being responsible for inspiring right-wing terrorist actions. I mean, he died in the early 1970s, so he was not around when the Bologna train bombing or train station bombing occurred in 1980, in August of 1980. But some of his followers, some of his admirers were implicated in this tragedy, and the judges who oversaw the trials connected with Bologna, the Bologna train station bombing, as well as the judges who oversaw the trials, the many trials in the Piazza Fontana bombing in Milan in 1969, all have concluded that there was an influence exerted by Evola's thought, that people inspired by his work really were motivated by ideas that he presented about the existing status quo as sort of a death sentence for Italy, for authentic European civilization, and really took those arguments from the intellectual realm into the political realm. There's a very interesting book, JG, that really deals with this question that you've raised. And it's the book by Eric Hoffer, The True Believer, in which he writes that every radical group, every radical individual really depends on what Hoffer calls a man of words, that men of action depend on men of words to devise alternative ways of organizing society, thinking about the world, thinking about history, thinking about the future. And I think for radicals in Italy, for a variety of different degrees, different forms of neo-fascists, Evola was an inspiration, including some radicals on the extreme violent end of that spectrum. It's not that everyone who read Evola or was inspired by Evola was a terrorist or wanted to be a terrorist, but some people were. Some people who read him came to the conclusion that the only answer for us to save Italy, to save Europe, is to blow up the status quo. And that, I think, was a signal for some of these terror bombings of the 60s and 70s and into the 1980s.
And I was just going to add to that, I mean, the Bologna massacre, this train bombing, I mean, it killed 85 people,
yes,
wounded more than 200.
Yes.
This is a massive event, and it really shakes Italy to its core.
The most destructive of the terror bombings occurred in Bologna. There were 7 or 8 major terror bombings over the 20-year period. Bologna was the worst of them, an appalling event. And it had a deeply, deeply disturbing effect on the country.
Last thing on Evola, is it fair what I said earlier that it's a bit more complex than Evola is someone that believes in just biology? He seems to have this Nietzschean and spiritualist element to him that I don't think people always consider when they look at fascism as a philosophy or neo-fascism as a philosophy.
There's definitely a Nietzschean component in his thought. And it's interesting that Evola became a rather celebrated figure in America in, I believe it was 2014, No, it was even later than that. It would have been 2017 when Steve Bannon, in an interview with the Italian media, praised Evola. He spoke about him in admiring terms. And of course, this immediately caused people to wonder, well, maybe there's a connection between Evolian neo-fascism and Trump's political ideas. In fact, that interview that he gave inspired a New York Times reporter to do some investigating about Evola. And in the course of his research, he discovered my book and contacted me about Evola. I said, what are the connections here? And my answer to him was, well, the connections would be very, very minor because Trump stands for right-wing populism in American politics, and Evola, a Nietzschean, a thoroughgoing Nietzschean in his political inclinations, was a stridently anti-populist.
He was an elitist.
Pardon?
He was very elitist. He
very
believed
elitist.
In aristocracy.
Yeah, he believed in aristocracy, that the last thing on earth Evola was interested in was the average man. The average man was of no real value at all. He fondly quoted Nietzsche on these points. He talked about the average person is only useful to the elites. And that's the only significance that men in the mass ever have, is how they're used by elites. And Evola accepted that completely. So my answer to the New York Times journalist, when he said, well, what do you think the connections are between Trump and Evola? I said, I don't think there are any connections at all. First of all, I doubt very much that Trump would have read him. I kind of doubted that Bannon had actually read him, because if he had, I don't think he would have argued that he was admirable from the point of view of right-wing American populism. That would have been the very last position that Evola would have taken. He was an elitist in the Nietzschean sense.
I think the bottom line with Evola, and then we'll move on, is ultimately this is a philosopher who believed the world was really everything was degenerating in his mind.
Oh, absolutely.
You know, everything was decaying. You know, it's almost like he I think he wanted to go back in time to this world that he imagined was more caste oriented, and that's sort of the end game of his ideology.
He thought that, you know, let me begin by saying that Evola fought in World War I, and he was born in the 1890s and was part of that generation of 1914. And in the aftermath of the First World War, the big book in Europe, especially for people interested in politics, was Oswald Spengler's Decline of the West, which came out in 1918, first volume, then a few years later, volume two.
It's had a lot of weird influences on various groups.
Yes.
I mean, it even influenced the beatniks in the U.S. At one point. Yeah,
I mean, the influence there was just almost across the spectrum. But Evola really found that book to be profoundly true, and that the world was in a downward spiral for reasons that Spengler outlines in his fascinating two-volume work. And that what we need to do is to find a way to arrest that downward spiral. Is there a way to revive the West? And his answer to that question, Evola's answer was, yes, there is, provided that we go back to ancient imperial Rome. Everything after the Roman Empire is decline and fall in the West for Evola. And that's the point of ignition for him.
It's a very different worldview, I think, than what liberals or even people on the left are used to. I mean, both Spengler and Evola, I think, almost view history as a circle, whereas, you know, a lot of people view history as being linear. They sort of view it as going around, you know, like the references to Kali Yuga and yugic cycles. They view it as cyclical.
Oh, I think that's absolutely true. I mean, the cyclical theory of history is in the sharpest possible contrast to what you call the linear view of history. That, you know, the sort of the Enlightenment idea that we're just moving forward steadily toward progress and enlightenment and utopia. The cyclical theory of history, of which Spengler was a prime spokesman, but by no means the first. There are other very important historians who built on that cyclical theory of history. Probably the greatest of them was an Italian, a 17th century, early 18th century Italian, Giambattista Vico, in his New Science. And he devised this cyclical theory, which he described in the following way, that every civilization, like every individual human organism, is conceived, and some of these organisms, a few, moving the analogy over to the civilization side and leaving the human side of the analogy, those civilizations with the internal power to generate high culture, of which there are about a dozen in the world, according to Evola and others writing in this tradition, reaches a point of maximum creativity. And then, for reasons that are particular to each of these historical cycles, then the decline sets in. And eventually the cycle is completed in death and destruction. And of course, what Spengler was arguing at the time of the First World War, the end of the First World War, is that the West is now in its downward cycle. There will no longer be original art and thought on the level of Dante and Beethoven, earlier figures. All that's over for Western peoples. And Evola completely accepted that as the absolute truth, that the existing status quo, the capitalist democratic status quo, into which Italy had been absorbed after its defeat in the Second World War, part of the American consumer society model, that this is end times. These are end times that we're living in. And the only thing for the heroic individual to do at this point, for the true knights of the spirit, the only thing for them to do is to resist, to find a way to resist effectively. And it's that kind of thinking that inspired the Ordine Nuovo and other radical groups on the right. And I think that's why the Evolian ideology is very helpful for us in understanding what the philosophical background is to these political developments.
Now, we've talked a lot about the sort of black terrorism. What about the red terrorism? What animates the red terrorism? And maybe we should begin with, what are some of the key incidents of red terrorism and what animates it?
Well, the most famous episode in Italy caused by left-wing red terrorism was the kidnapping and murder of Aldo Moro in 1978. Moro was the premier political figure in Italy. He was the real leader of the Christian Democratic Party, which was the regnant party. Even when he was out of office as prime minister, behind the scenes, he was the real power there in that party. And when the Red Brigades succeeded in 1978, in kidnapping him, and then later executing him in May of 1978, 54 days after they had captured him. This was a traumatizing event in Italian history, and it has never really gone away. I mean, the aftermath of it, the various conspiracy theories that have been woven about the Aldo Moro murder case are almost without number. And I've spent a lot of time dealing with that. I wrote a book about the Aldo Moro murder case after writing this book that we're talking about today. That other one came out in 95, actually. And so that would be the emblematic terrorist episode on the left. There are many, many others, of course. And a series of assassinations, series of kneecappings, kidnappings, terrorist attacks, thousands of them. But what were they after? They were after the overthrow of the capitalist status quo, but for Marxist-Leninist reasons. And again, as I said earlier at the start of our discussion today, there's a deeply entrenched radical left-wing culture in Italy that goes back to the 19th century, goes back really to the time of Karl Marx. I wrote a book about that as well, called Apostles and Agitators, about the deep historical background of Marxist-Leninist revolutionary culture. And it goes all the way back to the time of Marx.
I was going to add to that. I once had a guest on who was famous for writing a biography of Silvio Berlusconi, Alexander Still, a very good investigative journalist. And he said something to me that stood out. He said that there's two churches in Italy. There's the Catholic Church, and then there's the Communist Party. So I think you're right. There is a really entrenched sort of leftism in Italy.
Oh, deeply so. And it's interesting you say that, because I think that's an accurate depiction of what the Communist Party has been. It was a huge party, very powerful. And then, of course, when the Soviet Union disintegrated and disappeared from the map of the world, all those communist parties that had been founded in emulation of the Bolshevik Party in Russia, and the Italian Communist Party was one of them, suffered a mortal wound. They all either vanished or were reduced to mere shadows of their former selves. And of course, what's happened in Italy with the demise of the Communist Party, it turned into the eventually the Partito Democratico, the Democratic Party, but it's riven with factionalism. It has nothing like the ideological coherence that it had earlier when it was a truly Marxist-Leninist party, at least in aspiration. And so the left in Italy has been in disarray and really impotently so ever since. And that's why in Italian politics today, one hears very little about the radical left. It's all radical right and populist right. Those are the powerful surging forces there. But I think, and I argue in the, I wrote a new introduction for this 2021 second edition of the book. And I talk about the possibility that with the existing economic crisis in Italy, crisis over the economy, crisis over immigration, crisis over globalization, I think the potential for a return of some Marxist-Leninist ideas is present. And in this book that we're talking about, The Revolutionary Mystique and Terrorism in Contemporary Italy, I have two portraits of Marxist-Leninist revolutionary ideologues. Raniero Panzieri is one of them, Tony Negri is the other one. And I think reading those chapters, people will find the essential elements of the Marxist-Leninist revolutionary tradition, and it might also prepare them for some of the developments that could be coming up along in the future, political developments and ideological developments.
What were maybe some of the factors that animated the Tony Negris of the world and the Red Brigades in Italy? Because, I mean, there's various factions in the left. Why were the Red Brigades so radical? Was it just in response to right-wing terrorism? Did they see the crisis of capitalism as having reached a point where violence had become more necessary than ever? Was there a sort of apocalypticism that was mirrored on the far right at the time that we can also see in the far left?
It wasn't only in response to the radical right that the Red Brigades leaped into action around 1970, 1971. It also was in reaction to the Italian Communist Party, which had become increasingly moderate and really had abandoned its revolutionary ideas. The main leaders of the Italian Communist Party were reformists, and really seeking, by the time they got to Enrico Berlinguer, who was the secretary of the Italian Communist Party during the 1970s, a big part of the 1970s, he was trying to establish some kind of rapport with the Christian Democrats. And this was called the historic compromise in Italian politics, that the communist left and the Christian Democratic Center would get together and form a kind of combination government. The Red Brigades were aghast at that. They thought this is the most grotesque sacrilege that any Marxist-Leninist could ever hear about. And so I think the Red Brigades were reacting not only to developments on the radical right that we talked about earlier, but also to developments within the Communist Party. They saw the party moving more and more toward the hated center, really as a support element for the status quo, which the Red Brigades reviled as the worst kind of sellout of the proletariat.
They saw the party as moderating, in other words.
Oh, yeah, yeah. So in a way, the Red Brigade phenomenon can only be understood fully, I think, as a sort of an intramural communist development, as part of a dispute within the Italian communist culture about which way the party should go. Should it go in the direction of revolution or should it go in the direction of reform? And that's the classic debate on the Italian left, really going back to the creation of the Socialist Party in the 1890s. And it was out of the Socialist Party that in the aftermath of the Bolshevik Revolution, the Communist Party was created in 1921. I mean, to emulate in Italy what the Bolsheviks had done in Russia. And that split between people who think of socialism as a reform movement, as a democratic movement, that we should advance in conjunction with democratic and liberal elements, or the revolutionary side of that culture, which holds no, there's only one way to end this capitalist status quo, and that is through violent revolution. That's the only way to do it. As Marx himself and Lenin himself in State and Revolution, his 1917 book about how he led the Bolshevik Revolution, proclaim.
So just a few more things I wanted to cover here. You mentioned conspiracy theories earlier. There's, of course, a great deal of conspiracy theories around the Aldo Moro assassination. I've even seen pop cultural references in TV shows saying, oh, it was the CIA. You take the view that these conspiracy theories are incorrect, but there's a lot of paranoia, I think, that arises out of all this terror on both the far right and the far left. People often talk about these things like Operation Gladio, the P2 Masonic Lodge.
Oh, God, yes.
Is there any truth to any of these sort of conspiracies, or is there any reason that maybe people were right to be paranoid?
I mean, here's the way I proceeded in writing my books about Italian terrorism. I wanted to proceed as an historian. And I think one of the essential requirements for writing history in a professional sense is to anchor your argument in evidence. What's the evidence? What does the evidence show? And I followed all the parliamentary reports that have been published about terrorism in Italy, right and left. I followed the judicial trials, the testimony, the court findings. I read the memoirs. I read interviews. I conducted interviews. I studied the intellectual history of the right and left in Italy. All that really constituted the research base for my work. And on the basis of the evidence in the case, I could find no proof for the conspiracy theories. At the same time, I would add this. There's a very distinguished historian, now dead, but who taught for many years at the University of Padova, where I studied for a while myself at the time of the Piazza Fontana bombing. And Professor Angelo Ventura has written extensively on the years of lead, and he says this, it's true. We can't find any concrete evidence linking these various plots and conspiracies. You mentioned Operation Gladio. That's a very important one. Propaganda Due, the Masonic Lodge that Licio Gelli led, that was joined by many right-wing carabinieri officers, police officials, military people. Who hated Moro and may well have been ill-disposed toward him and may not have done their very best to find him while he was kidnapped for those 54 days. And I like the way Professor Ventura puts it in various books he's written about this, none of which I think is available in English. But his argument is, he said, look, we don't have evidence for these plots. And yet at the same time, anyone studying this period in Italian history must be aware of the presence of deviant elements in the secret services. We must be aware of these right-wing components in the Italian status quo, which may very well have played some kind of a role in the outcome of the Aldo Moro case and other terrorist events. but we don't have evidence for it. And in that sense, I've argued that no historian writing about this can venture into the world of conspiracy theories without really abandoning the professional character of his work.
I'd just like to add to that. I get the feeling that just taking a historical approach, I think at the very least we can say that there is sort of this subterfuge going on. Like when you look at Propaganda Due, I mean, Licio Gelli had very much political aims. And I mean, he's operating a Masonic lodge that I think even within Masonry was sort of a renegade lodge, and he does have sort of political aims. So there is sort of this subterfuge going on and these sort of political maneuverings going on beneath its surface, whether we get into those conspiracy theories about the Moro assassination or not. There is sort of maneuverings happening.
I think there's no doubt about that. I mean, the question, though, is, are there links between that maneuvering and the specific terrorist episodes we're investigating? And thus far, none of the investigators, none of the parliamentary investigators, none of the judges, none of the trials has produced the kind of evidence that would document for a certainty that the Licio Gelli or the Gladio figures were responsible for the outcome of these events, the Aldo Moro case in particular.
Well, it gets really wild in some ways, because there's even theories about, I've even seen people say that, oh, NATO was behind the death of Pier Pasolini, the famous poet and filmmaker. I mean, there's so many rabbit holes. And I sort of like that you don't dismiss everything, but you take that historian's approach and say, well, we should consider, you know, the subterfuge that was going on in Italy, but we have to look at what we can prove. In that regard, I guess, really briefly, could you describe this idea that comes up a lot when talking about this era of the strategy of tension? And then I have one more question after that.
Strategy of tension was a plan devised by the radical right to subject Italy's democratic institutions to maximum pressure in the hope that the system would crack up under the strategy of tension. These terror bombings, for example, assassinations that the radical right also carried out. They assassinated some judges in the 1970s. They're very important to know about. And the theory was that if we could just generate enough pressure on the system, that it would buckle. So it's the famous line of a great anarchist theorist, Mikhail Bakunin, who argued that in trying to overcome the hated state, capitalist status quo, all criminality, all subversive action, all of that are good. Everything of that kind is good. And that's what the strategy of tension was on the right in Italy in the years of lead.
Do you think there may be parallels between that and some of the things we see happening today in the U.S.? And I mean, not on the same level as what we saw during the years of lead in Italy, but, you know, I maybe there are parallels with something like, you know, the Capitol riots on January 6th, or do you think that may be going too far on my end? I'm not saying they're, you know, the same, but it seems like we are moving towards greater and greater extremes in some ways.
There's no question about that. I mean, I think the January 6th riots in Washington are profoundly revealing about deep levels of disturbance in American culture, in American politics, American political ideology. And really, you know, it's interesting that you raised this point at the very end of our discussion. I wish you would raise it at the beginning, because we could talk about it at length. There's a very important book written by Richard Hofstadter in the late 1940s, one of our most famous historians. The book is called The American Political Tradition, in which he makes the very sage observation that, no, there's no American Mussolini, there's no American Lenin, There's no American Hitler. In other words, American politics have been mainly centrist throughout our history. There have been exceptions to that, the American Civil War period being one. But for the most part, American politics have been relatively moderate compared with what the Europeans, and particularly the Germans and the Italians, have experienced. But that may be changing now. And as I was watching those scenes in Washington, and not only watching the scenes panoramically, but looking at the faces of the rioters, the hatred, the anger, the absolute, I'm thinking of an Italian word, the disprezzo, the complete contempt that the rioters had for the status quo they were attacking. This is new, I think, in American history. Not new in principle, because we've had that before at various stages, but I think the volume of it. I mean, the fact that Donald Trump received the amount of support he did in 2020, the 2020 election, is extraordinary. I mean, there's a deep well of approval of him. And I think there's something in the Trump phenomenon that reveals the potential in American politics for a degree of dissidence against American centrism, potentially novel and potentially serious.
And I would add to that, I think we even see a potential for a resurgence of a very radical left as socioeconomic conditions worsen, as people become more precarious. I think we're already seeing some of that. One last thing, though, before you go, I wanted to read something from the conclusion of your book and maybe just stick on it for a second. And that's this short paragraph. You write, "Conspiracy theories and socioeconomic theories, along with instinctual psychoanalytic and aggression frustration theories, help us to see individual aspects of the problem." And you're saying the problem in regards to understanding the years of lead. "But they fail to explain why Italy has experienced terrorism in an unusually virulent form. Foreign conspiracies are afoot everywhere, not just in Italy. Moreover, it would be extremely surprising if Italy alone were plagued by deviant elements of domestic secret service agencies." You go on for a little bit about, you know, short of accepting genetic theories of terrorism and criminality and whatnot, it would seem unreasonable to assume that Italy is naturally inhabited by more true believers and escapees from freedom than other countries. So you're pointing all of this out. There's these individual aspects. There's all these different explanations for why the years of lead occurred. What is the bottom line for understanding the years of lead? Because all of these various theories only seem to reveal aspects. So what would you say in closing about what is the bigger picture that maybe others have missed?
The bigger picture for me in explaining the years of lead in Italy concerns the power, the staying power, the deeply held faith across large sections of the Italian population of the radical left and radical right wing revolutionary traditions. This is why I think at the deepest level, my book was intended to be an intellectual history of Italian terrorism. I think you can go just so far looking at these individual aspects of what happened from 1969 to the late 1980s, but it's the historical structure. I think to understand the various aspects of Italian terrorism in the 1960s, 70s, and 80s, it's necessary to look at the historical context in which all these events took place, the broad, deep historical context, which for me is formed primarily by the deeply entrenched radical traditions on the left and the right in Italy. Earlier in the program, we talked about communism as a religious faith. I would say the same would be true about fascism and neo-fascism. There's a belief, these are belief systems. And true believers can be capable of extreme actions that people outside of those traditions really find very difficult to imagine or to believe. But what I found in reading the various memoirs of these left-wing and right-wing terror, they all really went through rites of passage in these radical traditions and became acculturated in them and believed in them and sought to promote them, not only intellectually, but through their life experiences.
In that regard, I just want you to clarify here. You're not saying, at the same time, you're not saying that things like socioeconomic conditions don't play a role, but you're also looking at a different aspect, the sort of belief system aspect of all of this.
Yeah, I mean, I think I said earlier that beginning in the early 1960s, the Italian economy began to suffer a decline. It began to stall, and unemployment problems became increasingly serious. Problems at the university became increasingly serious as these thousands of graduates had no professional future to look forward to. And in conditions like that, radical groups find followers. I mean, this is true historically. But what Italy had that I don't think any other country had to the same degree was this deeply entrenched culture that the intellectual robustness of those cultures, not only in the work of Evola and Pound, people we've talked about on the right, or Negri, Panzieri, Antonio Gramsci, Amadeo Bordiga. There are these heroic figures who promoted this revolutionary cause. In fact, one of the favorite phrases of the radical left during this period was living the revolution. That's what we're doing, living the revolution. And I think that's what Italy did to an extent that no other country did in this period. I think because they had a cultural framework that not only encouraged it, but it nourished it. I mean, there was a degree of stimulation in those cultures that helped to explain why the peculiar economic, social, academic circumstances of the 60s and 70s proved to be so hospitable for a violent explosion in the years of lit.
I've already kept you over time, but it just popped into my head that I should ask this, so I'm going to go ahead with it. Is there anything that the Italian state or figures like Aldo Moro could have done to tamper this down? Is there any failure on the part of figures like Aldo Moro or the Italian state in addressing the years of lead?
That is the very best question you've asked yet. And again, I'm sorry it comes so late in our program together. There's a marvelous book that comes to my mind when you ask this question. The book is by Joseph Conrad, and it's called Under Western Eyes. It's a book about terrorism in Russia in the late 19th and early 20th century. The book was published in 1911, so before the Bolshevik Revolution. But the theme of the novel concerns the role that the Tsarist government played through inept policies in exacerbating the problem of terrorism. It's a profound novel for anyone interested in the state's role in creating these problems, these terrorist problems. I mean, the example he uses is Russia in the late 19th and early 20th century. But I think it's a question that could be applied wherever terrorism is a serious problem. The Middle East, for example. I mean, what is the role of the status quo in the Middle East in aggravating the problem of terrorism, making the problem of terrorism worse than it might be otherwise? The same would be true in Afghanistan. It would be true in Yemen. The question you ask about Italy can be applied wherever terrorism is a serious threat. And so as for Italy, what could the Italians have done to have headed this off? This is a question that Aldo Moro himself wrestled with all the time. He was always trying to figure out a way. How can we tamp this down? And the strategy that he developed was to try to bring the Communist Party in to the government in the historic compromise. He thought that would be a strategy that might succeed in overcoming the worst of this violence, and marginalizing it, pushing these radicals more and more to the fringes. He didn't live long enough to see that happen. He was killed before that could happen. So his plan could not take, but I think that might have been something that would have been effective in at least limiting some of these problems, but who can say?
Is that what you're referring to when you say that at the very end of the book, you say that Moro's admonition remains in effect? I'm assuming that admonition is the unwillingness to not be as hardline when it comes to dealing with these things.
Oh yeah. No, he was the compromiser. I mean, he was a compromiser within the Christian Democratic Party. He was the man always looking for the balance point between the contending groups. And it was the way his mind worked. And I think that's what made him such an effective leader for so long.
A diplomatic mind, if you will.
Yeah, he was pragmatic. He was not ideological in that sense. Although he was deeply Catholic and deeply inspired by Catholic social justice theory. And so, I mean, it's not as if he was without convictions of his own. He had them. But he was able to try to look at the adversary in the wonderful phrase of Martin Buber in I and Thou, wonderful book in which Martin Buber, the existentialist Jewish philosopher, says the problem with politics today is that we have developed I-it relationships with the adversary. I-it, we have to change that from I-it to I-thou, that the adversary is equal in human terms. How do we do that? Well, we have to really stretch our minds and stretch our spirits and our souls. So I think more of that might have had a militating effect on the tragedy of the years of lead. That's the best answer I can give you to the Joseph Conrad question. You know, what is the role of government in exacerbating the problem of terrorism? That's the great question of that novel, that we can't just look at the terrorists. We can't just look at the neo-fascists and look at the Marxist-Leninists and say, oh, that's the problem of terrorism right there. No, the state always plays a role in the way it responds to those groups. Is it responding effectively, intelligently, or stupidly and criminally? That's the question.
Well, I think that's a great note to end on. I thank you for staying a little bit over time. Thank you so much, Richard Drake, for coming on Parallax Views.
You're entirely welcome, and I enjoyed it very much.
Well, that does it for this edition of Parallax Views. I hope you enjoyed my conversation with Richard Drake on his book, The Revolutionary Mystique and Terrorism in Contemporary Italy, available now in a brand new second edition. As always, let me know what you thought about this edition of Parallax Views by dropping me a line on Twitter at ViewsParallax or by email at parallaxviewspod@protonmail.com. Producers credit shoutouts to Catherine, Nathan, Holland, Mark, Chase, Zach, Omar, Ted, Gratz, Martin, Gary, Emilia, and Mickey. If you'd like your very own producer's credit on each and every edition of Parallax Views, well, consider joining those listeners in supporting me at the $10 or $15 tiers of my Patreon page at patreon.com/parallaxviews. That's patreon.com/parallaxviews. There is also a $1 tier and a $5 tier. Any amount will help. Your support is what keeps this show going. So if you appreciate the work I do, $1, $5, $10, $15, doesn't matter. Please consider supporting me on Patreon at patreon.com/parallaxviews. Again, that's patreon.com/parallaxviews. And with that being said,
until next time, you've been listening to Parallax Views with Parallax Views. To Parallax Views with Parallax Views.
The way out is not simply to say don't do it, just to prohibit. It's nothing else. If we don't do it, others will be doing it like crazy. So, you know, we have to confront the problem. But no, basically, I know of the great anxiety problems, new forms of control, but it's also new forms of freedom. This is why I always emphasize that internet and all this new digital stuff, it's a very ambiguous phenomenon, but it's the field of struggle. New forms of enslavement, but at the same time, new incredible forms of freedom. We have to accept the fight with no nostalgia for old, allegedly more authentic communities or whatever. I'm not afraid. I'm not afraid. I'm not afraid. I'm not afraid.